This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Over the past 2 weeks, some of the loudest voices speaking up against racism and police brutality have come from the sports world, from former NBA player Steven Jackson, who grew up with George Floyd and called him my twin.
You can't tell me when that man had his knee on my brother's neck, taking his life away with his hand in his pocket, that smirk on his face didn't say I'm protected.
To 2017 NBA Rookie of the Year, Malcolm Brogdon.
I got a grandfather that marched next to Dr. King in the 60s. And he was amazing. He would be proud to see us all here. We got to keep pushing forward.
To 16-year-old tennis star Coco Gauff speaking out in Florida.
I was 8 years old when Trayvon Martin was killed. So why am I here at 16 still demanding change? Yeah. And it breaks my heart. Because I'm fighting for the future for my brothers. I'm fighting for the future for my future kids. I'm fighting for the future for my future grandchildren. Yeah.
To the other side of the globe, where UFC fighter Israel Adesanya joined a protest in New Zealand.
Shout out to all the white people, all the people of different races being here, because we need you. We need you to speak up. We need you to say something, because I'm sick and tired of seeing those faces get killed, because guess what? I see myself in them.
To talk about all of this, I'm joined by someone we're fortunate to consider an Only a Game regular, Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Ken, welcome back.
Thank you, Karen.
I'd like to start with a bit of historical context. Over the past week, a lot of people have been reminded of the protests that swept the country in the late 60s and the LA riots of 1992. What, in broad terms, was the response from the sports community in those moments?
Well, interesting. So in the 60s, there was great responsiveness, great involvement. You had celebrities of the day, Jim Brown, were deeply engaged.
But as governor of the state of Georgia, did you go by the laws of God or by the laws of the state?
I go by the laws of God and by the laws of the state.
As you see fit.
And even some moments, in fact, when some great white athletes were involved, Ron Mixon, the NFL, and the great Jack Kemp. You know, it is interesting when you forge ahead to the 90s and the LA uprising following Rodney King and O.J. Simpson and sort of those moments, there was silence by the athletes. There were attempts, and most notably Craig Hodges with the Chicago Bulls was an outspoken person on this. But for the most part, there was a deep entrenchment of the Michael Jordan aura of the best way to get paid in this business is to be apolitical, raceless, and as colorless as you can be.
So how did we get from that era that you're describing of political apathy to what's happening now?
So it really was the Trayvon Martin moment, a great moment by LeBron James leading his then Miami Heat team in a way that we had not seen.
LeBron James tweeted a photo of himself and his teammates wearing team logoed hoodies.
The hoodies and using that tool that didn't exist in the 60s and the 90s, social media. We saw great action by some collegiate players, the then St. Louis Rams.
Five Rams players entered the field displaying the hands up, don't shoot pose.
It was an apparent show of solidarity with Ferguson protesters.
And certainly a great action by the WNBA Lynx players.
The warm-up jerseys named two black men shot last week by police.
The names of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile were on the back, along with the Dallas Police Department shield and Black Lives Matter.
So we have begun to see this greater movement and this greater moment, but certainly nothing like we're seeing today.
Right. So that was going to be my next question, because, of course, this has grown over the past few years, but this present moment does feel different. What stood out to you about the response from the sports community this time around?
Well, it's a combination of things. I think certainly we're able to hear it more clearly because the games are not being played. We don't have the distraction of the games themselves. I also think that graphically, seeing what we saw this time made us all open our eyes and ears to a level that we had not reached before. You know, the Black Glove protest in 1968 was two men standing on a victory stand raising their fist, and there wasn't an imagery of actual death accompanying it. The Trayvon Martin moment, we heard about it, we heard some sound, but we didn't see it. I mean, Eric Garner was the closest situation to this, but somehow it wasn't as brazen and blatant as this one.
Lavelle Mouton, head men's basketball coach for North Carolina Central, went on ESPN last weekend and said something I have not heard a coach say about his colleagues. He pointed out that college football and basketball coaches at the highest levels make generational wealth off of the athletic abilities of young men who look like George Floyd.
But whenever people, the complexion of George Floyd, is killed, assassinated, murdered in the street in broad daylight, they're silent. And I have a problem with that.
Does he have a point?
Well, he has a great point. And so often we have connected making money off the backs of predominantly African-American youth at the collegiate level. So often we've made that point in terms of pay for play and name, image, and likeness. So what he does is takes it even further and says, look, you're getting some value from these young men. You need to take some steps to protect them. There's a similar messaging that I hope to hear from the pro sports leagues, especially the National Football League. The NFL is the one league that is still largely dependent on African-American talent. I mean, the NBA is right behind, but this is your labor.
Well, speaking of the NFL, NFL teams have been putting out statements in support of the protests. Yet these are the same teams that have blackballed Colin Kaepernick for protesting police brutality by kneeling during the national anthem. The hypocrisy has certainly not been lost on people. What's been your reaction to this?
So I do applaud the fact that a statement was issued. That didn't have to happen. I'll tell you, though, and not just the NFL. So many of those statements do not specifically mention police brutality and police misconduct.
Here's what Roger Goodell says. The NFL family is greatly saddened by the tragic events across our country.
To me, they are missing the mark, and they are doing the wonderful Pollyanna kind of thing of let's all sing Kumbaya and get together.
There remains much more to do as a country and as a league.
No, this is a police brutality moment. Deal with that. And by the way, that's something that can be addressed as opposed to this more difficult issue of bringing people together in America. Let's stop killing people in America. Let's take that step and then move forward from there.
What have you seen coming out of the NFL that is good?
I've had a number of conversations with people at teams that are executives and the like saying, you know, what can I do beyond my team statement? The intertwining of these sports leagues with the police following 9/11, and you know, the great Howard Bryant has done some wonderful work on that. That's really coming to bear in this moment too. You might want to separate yourself a little bit from that, and you may want to take some affirmative steps to say, well, here's what's wrong with my partner that I celebrate and have Law Enforcement Day and all these kinds of things. There are some wonderful cops. Some of my best friends are cops, but there are some problems as well.
As far as the sports world's involvement in protest and social change, what are you going to be paying attention to going forward?
The actual programs that are initiated, the actual steps that are taken. As much heat as the NFL got for funding the Players Coalition, $90 million or whatever it is, following the Colin Kaepernick protest and then all the follow-up, what we have seen there, those men have actually moved legislation forward. They've actually gone to state legislatures and gone with the appropriate people, appropriate education, and said, here are the laws that we need. They are actually working on getting people that are wrongfully incarcerated out of the system. And, you know, and the police ride-alongs and then getting another police force and all that sort of thing in a way that athletes can do much better than you or I.
Finally, just a big picture question. What do you think this moment tells us about the place that sports and athletes occupy in American society right now?
I think because of the huge vacuum that exists in leadership in the White House, and no matter what you think of Donald Trump, he's certainly not united the country. So in the absence of that, it is a tremendous opportunity for these people, athletes, sports figures, leagues, that do have the attention and do have the respect of people to hopefully say some of the right things and do some of the right things as people are looking around for some wisdom.
Professor Kenneth Shropshire is the CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Let's get through this.
To my white friends, you all know me as the sports guy.
This is Reagan Griffin Jr. He's studying journalism at the University of Southern California. This essay, which he originally wrote for The Undefeated, is called A Letter to My White Friends.
When you have questions about who to start in your fantasy lineup or what trade rumors are floating around the NBA or who's good in the upcoming draft class, you come to me for answers. And I happily oblige.
I'll be up front with it right now. The Philadelphia Eagles are undoubtedly, without a shred of a doubt in my mind, were the losers of the 2020 NFL draft.
You figure that because I live and breathe the NFL and the NBA, you're better served deferring to my judgment. You value my opinion. You accept what I tell you, and you act on it. But sports is not the only subject on which you should consider my expertise. You see, I have this vest. It was given to me at birth, passed down from generation to generation. It constantly weighs me down. It puts a perpetual target on my back. I cannot take it off, even if I wanted to. I've grown stronger because of it, but I will likely never have the opportunity to display the true limits of that strength, because the vest will always be part of me. But in spite of its many drawbacks, I've come to love this vest. It isn't what defines me, but is deeply attached to the core of my concept of identity. This vest is what it means to be Black in America. You think I spend a lot of time studying sports? I spend every waking moment of my existence studying what it is to be Black in this country. I'm forced to, as is every African American. That melanin ain't going anywhere. I know what it is to be profiled, stigmatized, slurred, targeted, hunted. And I let it be known. It doesn't take too much time in the same room with me to realize that I'm not the silent type. In person, on social media, through my content, I am vocal about these issues. As a person who is continually living the Black experience, I try to offer answers. What is frustrating to me, however, is when it comes to this area of my expertise, my opinions tend to fall on deaf ears. Rarely is there action on my behalf, on behalf of every soul facing these issues. Why? I do not know. Maybe it's peer pressure. Maybe it's because by admitting there is a problem, you're admitting that by not taking action, you have been complicit in the problem. Maybe you simply don't care enough. Whatever it is, I'm through making excuses for you. We've been through too much. Laughed together, wept together, fought for each other, became family. For me to accept that you turn your back on me when I need you most. I don't stand alone in my pain. There are about 44 million of us experts in this country, and most of us are frustrated beyond words. I don't condone these riots happening across the country, but all of you who sit in silence have created this monster. We all have our white friends who sidestep these issues, and it's enraging that those who have the audacity to call us friends refuse to stand with us. In the words of Martin Luther King Jr., in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. This isn't about touchdowns, baskets, home runs, or goals. As much as I love sports, there will always be bigger issues than what's on a scoreboard. This is quite literally about life and death. I'm not asking you to understand. You could frankly never understand without having lived your life with that vest. What I'm asking for, demanding really, is your trust in our expertise. Take the same faith you have in me when it comes to sports and apply it to my and Black America's judgment when it comes to the issues facing our community. And act on it. Vocalize your support on social media. Talk with your families, particularly your younger siblings, about racism. Champion Black leaders and organizations in your community. Demand justice for the victims of police brutality. Advocate on our behalf in the spaces where we are not and cannot be present. Make it known that you will not tolerate injustice, even when it doesn't directly affect you. Where is it going to take me? Lying on the pavement, murdered in cold blood, to motivate you to care.
Reagan Griffin Jr. is a rising sophomore at USC. A longer version of this piece was first published by The Undefeated. Go to theundefeated.com for this and other great pieces exploring the intersections of sports, race, and culture. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Cell phone footage shows police killing unarmed Black people. Protesters take to the streets, rinse and repeat for a decade. Why?
Everyone moves on.
A blunt reminder that we've been here before on Code Switch from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. Among the many athletes speaking out this week is former NFL Pro Bowler Anquan Boldin. For Boldin, speaking out is nothing new. In 2017, along with Saints defensive back Malcolm Jenkins, Boldin founded the Players Coalition, which works with state and local governments to end systematic oppression. And that same year, after a 14-year career, Boldin retired from the NFL to focus on his activism full-time. But Anquan Boldin's younger brother, DJ, is just starting to speak out. And he started with the football players he coaches at Pahokee High School in Florida. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, DJ couldn't speak to his players in person. So he sent them a note on Twitter.
With times being very sensitive, I've dreaded having to say something. It's not a conversation I want to have with my 4-year-old son, let alone you all. I have 48 sons and counting.
Coach DJ Boldin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with a note you sent out to your players earlier this week. What made you decide to reach out to them?
To be honest, Karen, a lot of things have been going through my mind, and it dawned on me that I had a responsibility as a coach to say something. You know, we tell parents, you know, I'm going to take care of your kid. I'm going to treat him as if it's one of my own. Well, if that's the case, then you have to have these discussions. If they feel half of what I feel, they have to be confused. They have to be going through a turmoil of emotions. And it's my job as the adult, as the mentor figure, as the head coach figure, to address it.
I feel the same way you all are probably feeling right now emotionally. Hurt, angry, frustrated, and confused. I want to leave you guys with this. What you have witnessed over the last few days is morally wrong.
Tell me about your players. Who are they? What kind of backgrounds do they come from?
My team is comprised of 90-some% African-American and the other small percentage Latino. So obviously all of the kids look like me, if you will. And they are probably going to face the same profile and you know, all the other stuff that goes along with the color of my skin. And on top of that, it's a rural area. I mean, it's a little over 4,000 people in the entire city. Low social economical class, Section 8 housing, food stamp. We don't have a chain restaurant. We don't have a chain grocery store. There's no outlets for kids to be kids, meaning no skating rink, no bowling alley, no movie theater. You know what I'm saying? So these kids already face a lot just from life itself. So to add more fuel to the fire, if you will, and show them racism and to put in their face that, yeah, you are different, I think that's a slap in the face to the kids.
So you also grew up in this same small town where you now teach U.S. and world history and coach football. You played on the Pahokee High School football team, and then you went on to play at Wake Forest University. And you've said football shields you. How so?
Football, man, it's a brotherhood. Obviously, you see people of all nationalities, of all colors, of all socioeconomical backgrounds. The guy next to you is the guy you have to depend on. It's kind of one of those things where everybody has to trust everybody. So there's no room for, you know, the separation of race. Once you get outside of the realm of football, you have to face reality. And the reality is what we've been seeing over the last few days.
In 2015, your family suffered quite a tragedy. Tell me about your cousin, Corey Jones. Who was he and how did he die?
Oh, my gosh. Corey is an angel now. He's always been an angel. Corey was always that relative that was supportive. He was a character. He likes to crack jokes. You know, he loves to laugh and he loved music. I mean, his life was pretty simple. You know, he stayed around the church. His grandfather is the bishop of our ministry, and he played the drums for his grandfather. He used his gift and skill of playing drums to earn a living. And that night when he was, you know, taken away from us, he was coming from a gig. You know, he had performed. He broke down on the side of the road while he was waiting for roadside assistance. I mean, the audio tape speaks for itself.
I-95 exit PJ.
This is the audio of Corey's call to roadside assistance. And just a warning here, this is disturbing.
Is there any buildings, landmarks, anything like that, that I could use to pinpoint your address?
A unmarked police officer came on the scene, never addressed who he was, but asked Corey, did he need help? Corey was like, I'm good.
I'm good. Y'all good? Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Corey started to flee, and as he was fleeing, he was shot multiple times and killed. That was a very dark moment for a lot of us in our family because it happened to a guy that did nothing wrong. I would have rather it been me. I haven't led a perfect life, you know, and I'm not saying he's perfect at all, but, you know, what meets the eye is a guy that was a genuinely good person, and everybody that he's ever came in contact with would say the same thing.
And in Corey's case, the police officer who killed him was convicted and sent to jail. Does that help at all?
No, I'm going to tell you why it doesn't help. Yes, it's some type of vindication. It's an anomaly, if you will. It's one victory versus thousands of losses. And my family still grieves with the nation. Like, yes, the officer is paying for his crimes, but the officer has left a residue, if you will, of guys that do the same thing that he's done.
So every time you hear that this has happened again, as it did recently with George Floyd, what's that like for you?
It's like a knife just that's already in your back, just going an inch deeper. It can happen to me. Like, it really can happen to me. And I like to believe that I'm a great guy. You know, I like to believe I'm a great coach. I like to believe I give love. I sacrifice. I give my time. Yes, I have tattoos. Yes, I'm a big black guy. Yeah, I got a full beard. I probably do look intimidating to some people, but it's a sad reality that can be me for no reason. I pray to God that it doesn't happen to another one of my family members, yet alone my own children.
Yeah. In your note to your players, you didn't expressly mention your cousin. Am I right in assuming that's a story they already know?
Yes. You know, everybody knows about the situation. I believe that's why the message probably touched the hearts of my kids so well, because they already know what we've been through.
Football is a great sport, but if you don't learn anything else from the past few days, learn this. There are bigger things in life than football. Use all the resources football brings and educate yourself. Learn the law, become cops, attorneys, governors, mayors, judges, or even a president.
So how did your players respond to your note?
So I've coached in the NFL and I've coached in very different high schools. This kid that I coached in Memphis, Tennessee, at St. Benedict of Arbondale, it's a private Catholic school. He's a Jewish kid. He's one of my favorite kids in the entire world. And one day I told him, I was like, hey, man, I can see you being the president one day. And he laughed. He was like, Coach Bolden, first of all, how many Jewish presidents do you know? I was like, I know. I know. You know, you can actually be the first, you know. And he's like, oh, Coach Bo, you're crazy. I'm not politics. And after I posted that message, he texts me at 1 o'clock in the morning. He says, stuff like what's going on right now really makes me consider when you tell me to run for office. This is such a gratifying moment because I preach a lot to my kids. You get two lives to live. You get the football life and you get the real world life. And I use my brother Anquan a lot. He had a 14-year career, right? Very successful NFL career. And he retired at, what, 35, 36? You know, statistic has it, you're supposed to retire at 65. So you talk about 30 more years of life to try and figure out. And, you know, Anquan is doing a great job integrating back into the real world. But I can guarantee you the first couple years of his retirement, he didn't know what he was going to be doing. He probably still don't know, and I believe what he's doing with the justice reform and the NFL Player Coalition, it is pushing him in the direction of his path. But right now, he's a normal American citizen that has to figure out life. And now you take this one kid that I coach at 16-year-old, already knows what he want to do in life. He's already the future. That's what our job is as head coaches, to prepare the next generation of kids to be better than what we were.
When you finally do get a chance to see your players in person again, how do you intend to keep this conversation going?
I hope that they have more questions for me than I have answers. It's just going to force me to be more vulnerable to my kids. And I believe when you are vulnerable to kids and you show them and tell them the truth, the bond grows stronger, the trust grows stronger. And hopefully with that approach, you know, I can make them a better human being, not a better football player, but just a better human being once this is all said and done.
I can say so much more, and when the time permits, I will. But I want you guys to know Coach Bolden loves y'all, and I'm always one phone call away.
Protests this week have spread from Minneapolis to around the country and even the world. What do you hope comes out of this movement?
I see this whole process as a grieving process. If you lose a loved one, no one can tell you how to grieve, right? There's just a whirlwind of emotions, of outcry, and just actions that probably don't make sense to a lot of people, but it makes sense to you. After everybody heals from their mourning, it's so important for them to educate themselves and to take action. And I'm speaking to me first, you know, I'm already registered, you know, to vote. I'm already educating myself on the mayor, the commissioner, the district attorneys. If the people of this country do not educate themselves, and if they don't go out and vote, all of this would be for nothing. Period.
DJ Bolden coaches football and teaches history at Pahokee High School in Florida. DJ, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen.
This is the moment I usually take to remind you to subscribe to the Only a Game podcast. But this week, I'm going to suggest you subscribe to NPR's Code Switch instead. It tackles the subject of race head on. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. When a baseball card collector told long-retired MLB All-Star Gary Templeton about his 49-day road trip to meet some players whose cards were in his collection, Templeton was confused.
First, I thought it was like a little cuckoo, and I didn't know if he was for real or not.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Dissatisfied with the NFL's official statement on the killing of George Floyd, which said merely that the NFL was, quote, greatly saddened by, quote, tragic events, a group of NFL players released a statement of their own.
We, the National Football League,
admit wrong and silencing our players from peacefully protesting.
We, the National Football League,
believe Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter.
What did you make of the NFL's official statement?
Oh, God, it was awful. It was hollow. It was disingenuous. It revived the whole Colin Kaepernick thing. Everybody in the NFL should have anticipated that. And it was transparently insincere. There's no reason to believe the NFL on this issue at all.
Well, as you say, the events of the past few weeks have led many to say that now is the time to sign Colin Kaepernick to an NFL contract. Do you think any teams are going to be moved by that argument?
It'll be interesting to see if that happens. This has been the game all along, which is basically to blackball him until you can argue that he's been out of football too long. That's been the long game these guys have been playing. But it's entirely possible the pressure will become overwhelming.
So what should sports leagues be doing and saying right now?
Well, I think they should put their money where their mouths is in terms of community development and community policing. I think, you know, they should start paying back the society that has, you know, made them rich, basically, far more than they already have.
After facing backlash for telling an interviewer that he would, quote, never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America, New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees has apologized.
I am sorry, and I will do better, and I will be part of the solution, and I am your ally.
I am generally a Drew Brees fan, and he's done a lot of good things. On the other hand, does a person really make a turnaround in less than 24 hours? Where do you land on this?
I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt for the reasons that you just explained. I think he's got to get it through his head that the people who kneel are not disrespecting the flag. They are, in fact, engaging in everything that flag stands for. They are making a statement during a ceremony in which they are saying that the country is not living up to its ideals. And that's the most American thing you can do. And if Drew Brees has gotten to this point in his life where he doesn't know that, and he's willing to educate himself, that's fine by me.
Charlie, Basketball Hall of Famer Wes Unseld died this week at the age of 74. Unseld played for the Bullets in Baltimore and Washington from 1968 to 1981, and he went on to coach the team. How will you remember him?
As a big, hardworking center who took no nonsense, and as the greatest outlet passer in the history of basketball, and as a trailblazer in terms of civil rights. He was the first African-American player to be offered a scholarship at Kentucky, which he turned down and to play at Louisville.
The NBA Board of Governors has approved a return-to-play plan that would include 22 teams, 13 from the Western Conference and 9 from the East, training camps to open on July 9th, play to begin on July 31st, and all of this is meant to take place in Disney World. I am pleased. You?
This whole proposal completely embarrasses Major League Baseball because you've got a cooperative enterprise between labor and management here getting the sport back. Whether or not it's a good idea, we'll know, 2 weeks in when the incubation period ends.
Well, as you mentioned, Charlie, hopes for a 2020 baseball season are dwindling. The Players Association countered the league's plan for an 82-game regular season and additional pay cuts with a plan for a 114-game season and no additional pay cuts. Now the league has rejected that plan and says there will be no counteroffer. Is it all over for baseball in 2020?
It doesn't sound good, does it? I mean, there's a lot of room between those two proposals. Pay cuts? No pay cuts. 82 games, 114 games. It's hard for me to believe that they will make the entire season auger in. It would be an enormously stupid move on everybody's part.
And finally, Charlie, sports has returned to England. And the first sport back is, well, I'm not even sure I can call this a sport, can I?
You know, of course you can. This is only a game. We call everything sports.
What do you think of the return of pigeon racing?
Well, apparently the Barnsley Federation of Racing Pigeons is over the moon at the return of pigeon racing to the United Kingdom. Almost 4,500 pigeons were released to fly the 90 miles home. That's a heck of a race, actually.
My favorite detail coming out of the story is from a pigeon racer who said that the restrictions were lifted sooner than he expected. And so some of his birds weren't ready to race. Wait, is there some sort of extensive training camp for pigeons?
Unless you've seen pigeons lifting weights, your career as a sports journalist is not complete. Pigeons pumping iron, I'm telling you. Great video.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Our last story of the day might seem, at first, to be about a particularly obsessive baseball card collector who set out on a journey to meet some of the players he admired as a kid. But one of the things that baseball card collector found on his journey makes this story relevant to the news of the week. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
In 1986, when he was 5 years old, Brad Baluchian started collecting baseball cards.
I would buy the wax packs from the local pharmacy with a stick of gum. I had my favorite players who were not the superstars. They were the more underdog type guys.
Brad grew up to be a college professor who collected bugs instead of baseball cards. But in 2014, he turned his attention back to his childhood obsession.
The guys that I grew up following, I never really stopped thinking about them. I was always drawn to wanting to know the stories of those players. Where are they now?
Brad took his boxed-up cards out of storage and started formulating a plan to learn firsthand about players, or at least some of them.
So I thought a good way to get at this question of, you know, what happened to these guys that I grew up with would be to get a pack, and whatever guys are in that pack, those should be the guys that I would track down. I mean, that kind of captures the thrill that we experience as kids opening baseball cards, which was you don't know who you're going to get. And, you know, it's this series of surprises.
So Brad bought an unopened 1986 Topps pack on eBay. When it arrived, he removed the wax wrapper and popped the decades-old stick of gum into his mouth. He says it tasted delightfully gross. The pack included one player, Al Cowens, who died in 2002. But the remaining 13 cards were of living players, a group Brad calls a tantalizing mix of greatness and mediocrity. Brad Baluchian began planning a 49-day road trip for the summer of 2015. He would drive his 2002 Honda Accord from his home in Oakland, down the West Coast, across the South, into the Northeast, and back again. His goal was to have a meaningful conversation with each former player about their lives now. Brad's first stop was with Rance Mullinix.
Gracious, understated, humble, accommodating.
He also met with his childhood hero, former Phillies pitcher Don Carmen, and also with Randy Reddy, Steve Yeager, Jaime Kokenauer, Lee Mazzilli, Richie Hebner.
Guarded.
And Rick Sutcliffe.
Outgoing, extroverted, what you see is what you get.
The abstainers were Gary Pettis, Vince Coleman, and the famous and famously reclusive Dwight Gooden and Carlton Fisk.
I'm disappointed that Fisk was not willing to cooperate.
Brad managed to spend time with 9 of the 13 living players from his 1986 wax pack. But on his 49-day road trip, Brad had one meeting that feels particularly relevant today. On June 24, 2015, Brad arrived in San Marcos, California, where Gary Templeton now lives. A few months earlier, Brad had contacted Templeton and told him about his plan.
First, I thought he was like a little cuckoo, and I didn't know if he was for real or not.
That's Gary Templeton. When the pair met at a local restaurant and began to chat, Brad says he was nervous because he wanted to ask Templeton about a controversy from his days as a player for St. Louis.
Other writers had asked him about it, and he seemed to not volunteer anything. So I just came out and said, I want to talk to you about the Whitey Herzog incident.
It's water under the bridge, but, you know, it's something that he wanted to know. So, you know, I just told him the truth on what I remembered from the incident.
Here's the story. In 1981, Gary Templeton was a 2-time All-Star.
There's a line drive in the right center. That's got overspin. It'll take off and go to the wall. Durham will be waved. Templeton will end up at third with a triple.
Templeton was being paid more than any player in Cardinals history. But during the 1981 season, he hadn't been playing well. In late August, he went to team physicians.
And the Cardinal doctors told me that I had torn cartilage in my knee and I had sprained some ligaments in my ankle.
The Cardinals were leading their division and battling with the Dodgers for the best overall record in the National League when Gary and team doctors brought the extent of his injuries to the attention of Cardinals manager Whitey Herzog.
And Whitey told me, look, we're going to need you down the stretch, so I don't want you hurting yourself. So, you know, if you hit a routine ball and you know you out, just take your time getting down to first base because I don't want you hurting yourself.
On August 26th, the Cardinals hosted the San Francisco Giants. In the first inning, Gary struck out swinging on a curveball in the dirt. The ball got by the catcher, but Templeton didn't run to first base. The Cardinal had committed a baseball sin. But he says he was just doing what his manager had told him to do.
Of course, the fans don't know that. Their perception is that he's just being lazy and he's loafing.
Gary returned to the dugout.
I mean, the fans start booing me and screaming and yelling at me, and I'm like, what the heck is going on?
A group of particularly abusive fans had moved to the front row. Some were screaming the N-word at him.
Whitey was right there watching the whole damn thing because they was closer to Whitey than to me. They're throwing ice and all kinds of stuff at me, and that's when I stuck my hand up and flipped them off.
Templeton wouldn't tell me exactly what else they said.
He didn't want to tell me either. But according to reports, the hecklers continued from the stands. In the third inning, Gary had had enough.
And I was telling them to bring the out here on the field and whatever, and that's when I grabbed my crotch. And the home plate umpire noticed it, and Bruce Froman threw me out of the game.
Gary walked back to the Cardinals' dugout amid a torrent of abuse. When he arrived, Whitey Herzog grabbed him by the jersey and violently pulled him off the field and down the steps. The story made national headlines.
And the way that this is depicted in the press the next day is that Templeton got booed for being lazy, and then he just flips out and, you know, starts flipping off the crowd. What is not included in there is a description of all the horrible racial things that were hurled at him by the fans. And what especially upset Templeton was that Whitey Herzog, the other players, they also heard what was being said.
I don't know why nobody's never said anything about it, but they was right there. The two bad boys heard the whole thing. Later on, they was like, yeah, Gary, we heard it, but we couldn't say nothing. They were saving their jobs.
When the story was reported in the papers, Gary says only one half of it came out.
So, you know, they were just going by what Whitey Herzog told them. And, you know, and whatever Whitey said, I guess back then was gospel.
Gary was suspended for 3 weeks and fined $5,000. In order to return to the team, he was required to undergo evaluation.
And then they put him in this psychiatric ward for a while, trying to analyze what was wrong with him and diagnose him. And this is where Templeton basically says, I was in there playing ping pong all day. There was nothing wrong. But essentially, in order to rejoin the team a couple weeks later, they had to have the company line, which is that he was depressed or he was struggling with, you know, some kind of chemical imbalance. And he basically just towed the line and said, okay, fine, if that's what I need to do to get back on the field, sure, I'm depressed.
Brad Baluchian says Gary didn't want to go into the details of that stay.
And I think largely that incident stained his legacy for the rest of his career, which is so unfortunate because, again, when you know the whole story in the bigger context, it's just terribly unfair that that's how it went down.
Gary Templeton was traded to the Padres after the 1981 season. He played another 10 seasons and even made an All-Star team for the third time in his career. As for the incident on August 26, 1981, he says he's not proud of it, and he doesn't like talking about it.
I moved on. I mean, because nothing good ever comes from hating on stuff that you can't change, so I just move on in life.
Following his playing days, Templeton coached and managed for 2 decades. These days, he golfs and spends time with his grandkids near San Diego. 5 years have passed since Brad Baluchian's 49-day road trip, and he's had time to reflect on what he learned about pro ball players.
To some extent, I was still seeing them through the 8-year-old's eyes. But the things that were most impressive about them now are their ability to be vulnerable and to be open and to share some of their struggles. Collectibles are nice, autographs are nice, but you know, it's not about the object, it's not about the baseball card, it's about now knowing the actual human beings that are depicted on those cards.
But of course, Gary Templeton already knew that.
Major leaguers are people, they're human beings. I mean, they got hearts too, they hurt.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Brad Baluchian wrote a book about his road trip. It's called The Wax Pack, On the Open Road in Search of Baseball's Afterlife. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.